From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. If you're looking for a new car that'll save money on gas, you'll probably compare the miles per gallon the different models get. And you might be making a fundamental mathematical error. That's what a couple of researchers found when they asked people to rate the gas savings they could get from different cars. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
At Duke University in North Carolina, Richard Larrick studies how people decide what to buy. He says his best guinea pig is himself. Recently, his two-car family was trying to decide how to save money on gas. Should they replace their gas-guzzling minivan with a slightly more efficient station wagon? Or should they dump their fairly thrifty sedan and replace it with a super-efficient hybrid?
The improvement on the minivan to a station wagon just didn't look very impressive. It was like 18 miles per gallon up to 28 miles per gallon.
Just a 10-mile-per-gallon improvement.
And when we compared replacing a sedan, which was getting about 30 miles per gallon, with a hybrid that was very efficient that got 50 miles per gallon, that looked very impressive.
A whole 20-mile-per-gallon improvement. So, dump the sedan and get the hybrid, right? Wrong.
When we did the math and realized we drive both cars about the same distance, we realized that 18 to 28 ends up saving twice as much gas as the 30 to 50 improvement.
How could that be? Well, Larrick calls it the miles per gallon illusion. It turns out that not every increase in miles per gallon saves the same amount of gas. In fact, if you trade in a 15-mile-per-gallon car for a 20-mile-per-gallon car, you'll save much more gas than if you go from a 35-mile-per-gallon car to a 40-mile-per-gallon car. That's because gas guzzlers use so much more gas per mile. So even a 5-mile-per-gallon improvement in a gas guzzler means a lot less gas used for every journey. If a car gets more miles per gallon in the first place, the gas savings from the same improvement are less.
And we worry that people have a kind of why bother reaction when they look at cars that get 12 mpgs and think about raising it to 15 mpgs. That doesn't look big enough, but it saves a lot of gas.
In fact, Larrick conducted two surveys asking people to make car comparisons. And sure enough, most of them chose a car with the biggest improvement in miles per gallon, not the one that actually saved the most gas. Larrick says if America wants to use less gas, the priority should be get the most inefficient cars off the road right away, not try to get everyone to buy a super-efficient hybrid. Larrick published his findings in the journal Science. A lot of the confusion would disappear, he says, if the U.S. did what the rest of the world does, that is, compare cars by how many gallons per mile they use. Larrick's car buying decision then makes sense. Going from his minivan to a station wagon would save him 3.6 gallons of gas every 100 miles. Replacing the sedan with the hybrid would save only about half that.
I think it's useful reporting this fuel economy in gallons per mile, which I agree makes more sense.
David Green is an energy analyst at the Federal Department of Energy.
Especially when one is comparing vehicles for the kinds of things you want to do today, which is save money or reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Green says the government actually calculates gallons per mile when it sets fuel efficiency standards for American cars. He says consumers can do that too at a website, www.fueleconomy.gov. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Congress has yet to approve a method to attack global warming on a large scale. One plan to do that was easily defeated the other day. But the state of California is working on its own system. The state has already approved a law to limit carbon emissions. Now, state regulators face the hard part, trying to figure out how the law is supposed to apply to real people and real businesses. Some possible problems become apparent when you simulate the way the system works. And on a recent day, Rachel Miro of member station KQED went to class with people who've practiced the system called cap and trade.
Here's how it works. Regulators set mandatory limits on various kinds of industrial emissions. Firms that need to exceed their limits, or caps, can buy permits from firms with allowances to spare. Hence the phrase cap and trade. If this sounds intimidating, it might help to go back to school. To Energy and Environmental Markets in room C210 at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. There are two professors, Severin Bornstein and Jim Bushnell. The crowning glory of the course is a computer simulation of an electricity market. Professor Bushnell leads the post-game analysis.
So this is game A, round one. What was your thought process in putting together your bids for your portfolio?
Competing groups of classmates, each with different portfolios of power generating plants, vied with each other to get the best price for their power over 3 weeks. Professor Borenstein says the simulation was inspired by real-world events. When a few years back, California was pushed into the national headlines. The state had deregulated its electricity market, and soon after, energy traders figured out how to game the market, nearly bankrupting the state's biggest utilities.
We first introduced the electricity strategy game during the electricity crisis, so students would have a better understanding of what went wrong in the California electricity market by actually putting them in the position of firms, deciding how much to produce and how much to charge.
Borenstein and Bushnell predicted California's energy crisis. They were ignored at the time. But in the classroom, it becomes clear students put in a position to manipulate the market do so all on their own. For example, the professors updated the simulation to account for carbon trading. So after a first round of straight-up power trading, the teams had to reduce their carbon output by 10% and trade permits. Professor Bushnell describes what happened next.
Now in Game A, these guys bought up most of the credits and they announced, we're tearing up half the credits, and so you got to pay us a high price if you want to get carbon credits from us. Was anybody surprised by this? Or was sort of the rumors floating around? You guys were? Yeah, you guys were kind of upset, as I recall.
Class lesson number one. In any market, social concerns, even broader economic stability, take a back seat to making money as efficiently as possible. Professor Borenstein says it's critical to stress test your market design before you ring the opening bell.
What's going to happen in the real world when some people are out to make as much money as they can?
He's not just talking from the sheltered confines of the ivory tower. Borenstein and Bushnell have experience as electricity regulators in California. It's a fair bet some of their students will go on to serve as carbon trading regulators. After the class is over, Greg Croft says he was taken aback during the simulation, but not by his classmates gaming the market. His concern reflects the second big worry public policymakers have about carbon trading.
It hugely increased the electricity prices. I mean, this is the only example I've seen, and we had two different games going within the class, and it happened in both games.
Cap and trade is not the only strategy under serious consideration by economists, environmentalists, and public policy wonks. Some of them would prefer to simply tax emissions, but taxes are widely considered a much harder sell politically. California regulators could decide to opt for cap and trade and taxes. Whatever strategy they go for, the state should prove a handy test case, a simulation, if you will, for the rest of the nation. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Miro.
Today, John McCain headed to the heart of the nation's oil and gas industry. He spoke in Houston this afternoon, where he outlined his views on energy. He called for more offshore oil drilling, and later tonight he'll do some prospecting of his own. He'll attend a pair of fundraisers. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now from Houston. And Scott, we just heard Barack Obama talking in Detroit about reinventing the auto industry. What was John McCain's message there in oil country?
Melissa, you don't come to Houston and talk about plug-in hybrid cars, I guess. John McCain says in the weeks to come he will offer some bold proposals for new forms of energy, but what he offered today was old-fashioned carbon-based supply-side remedies. He wants, as you say, to lift the federal moratorium that prevents offshore drilling along most of the nation's east and west coasts, and he also wants to provide new incentives for the states. So even if the federal ban is lifted, there's a lot of state opposition to offshore drilling in places like California and Florida. McCain hopes by giving those states a bigger piece of the royalty pie, that might calm some of that opposition.
Now, all of this comes at a time when drivers are angry about gasoline that's $4 a gallon and headed higher. Would these ideas of John McCain help?
No. In the short run, they would not. Even though McCain said yesterday that lifting the moratorium on offshore drilling would provide short-term relief, even people who support the plan, like the American Petroleum Institute, concede it would be 7 to 10 years before you'd actually see any additional oil. In other words, the next president, even if he served two terms, would be a lame duck before that oil started flowing. That's not to say it's not worth doing, but it's not going to bring gasoline prices back to $2 or even $3 a gallon this summer or next summer or the summer after that.
Now, what about some of the short-term ideas that John McCain has proposed previously, like the summer gas tax holiday?
He repeated his call for that lifting of the 18 cents per gallon federal tax on gasoline today. That's something that's been popular with a lot of drivers, although it's been roundly criticized by economists who say, first, that it really wouldn't save the average driver a whole lot of money, maybe $20 per car over the course of the summer. And also that it would send the wrong message at a time when we want to be encouraging people to use less gasoline. This might, at the margins, encourage them to use a little bit more. While economists have criticized John McCain's gas tax holiday, they've also criticized the Democrats' proposal for a tax on windfall profits of oil companies. And John McCain joined that chorus of criticism. He got lots of support from the oil industry executives in the audience today when he lambasted Barack Obama for the windfall profits tax. And there was a chorus of boos here in Houston.
You know, John McCain has also been making efforts to appeal to environmentalists, Scott, with his proposals on climate change. Was there anything for them in his speech today in Houston?
Yes, he did, for example, say that he still opposes oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. He says there are some parts of the country that are just so pristine they shouldn't be disturbed for oil drilling, no matter how clean the drilling technology has become. And he also gave a pointed plug to conservation, saying it's no longer just a moral luxury or personal virtue. That was a fairly overt dig at Dick Cheney, who famously dismissed conservation as a mere personal virtue. So John McCain did give a nod to conservation. It wasn't much more than a nod, but it was something. And I guess it's probably too much to expect a candidate to talk about higher fuel economy standards right before a couple of fundraisers here in Houston.
Okay, Scott, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Melissa.
It's NPR's Scott Horsley in Houston with the John McCain campaign. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Living on the shore has always been risky. Storms and hurricanes take their toll on beachfront houses. Well, now global warming is raising sea levels and threatening to move a shoreline inland. Consider the saga of one home on the Texas Gulf Coast. Independent producer David Barron has that story. It's part of the series we call Shifting Ground. Today, battle lines in the sand.
Surfside, Texas. It's a small beach town south of Houston. No fancy condos here, no high-rise developments, just one traffic light, rows of cottages on tidy lawns, and at 809 Beach Drive, a house painted sky blue. A plastic sign displays its name.
The Sandcastle.
Brooks Porter and his wife Mary bought the Sandcastle a quarter century ago. They wanted a beach house that the family could use and that they could rent out for income.
We wanted a fixer-upper because that's what we could afford.
We were looking for a house that needed somebody to care about it.
And it was perfect.
In other words, it was a wreck, but you couldn't beat the location.
We had sand dunes and salt grasses growing in front of our house.
And just beyond, the beach. Since then, Surfside has seen some of the worst erosion on the Texas coast. The dunes are gone. So is the salt grass. The house now sits at the water's edge, stranded like a beached whale. A whale on stilts, that is.
The house is up out of the ground by a good 10 feet.
This is a pretty unusual situation to be, have a house above and seashells and, some seaweed and the waves are right there.
Yes, the water, you can tell that occasionally it's going to come up underneath the house.
But the Porters say it's not the water that worries them.
The real threat to our family's house is not hurricane and flood. It's from the state of Texas.
The Porters have been engaged in a decade-long struggle with the state government, and it's a fight that may foreshadow battles in other coastal areas. At issue, what happens when the public beach moves onto private property? You see, in Texas, and to varying degrees in other states, the beach is essentially a park.
You can't go out and build a house on a state park.
And you can't keep a house on a state park, even if the house was there first and the park moved under it, says former state senator Babe Schwartz. He's an author of the Texas Open Beaches Act, a 50-year-old law that declares the beach a public way.
If you've got any piece of your structure on what is state land, then you're not entitled to keep it there.
That's what the state told Brooks Porter and some of his neighbors back in the late 90s. By then, the beach had moved inland onto their lots.
They said, we want you to remove your houses from your lots because of the Open Beach Act.
Brooks Porter said no. He and some neighbors hired a lawyer.
Your Honor, there are three separate motions in behalf of the plaintiffs.
Houston attorney Ted Hertz represented the homeowners at more than a dozen hearings in district court beginning in 2001. He argued that the houses shouldn't have to be removed from the beach because they didn't interfere with the public use of the beach.
The public can still sunbathe around them. The surfers can still surf. No one is adversely affected.
That argument failed. The judge ruled that the homes violated the law and would have to go. Eventually. For the time being, the houses could stay, he said, while the case was on appeal. But the judge barred the homeowners from making any repairs. So when an especially high tide knocked out sewer and water pipes several years ago, Brooks and Mary Porter couldn't reconnect them.
You see, turn it on and nothing happens.
Mary Porter stands by the kitchen sink.
No water coming out of the pipes.
So,
no, sir.
No using the bathroom.
No using the bathroom. That's
that
right.
That kind of makes the house not very usable.
Makes it difficult for spending the night for just anything.
But the Porters remained undeterred. They pressed another argument with the state. They said it's unfair for the government to punish them because the government created this predicament. You see, coastal erosion here and elsewhere is not a purely natural phenomenon. Government projects like dams, jetties, and ship canals can rob the shore of sand. And studies show that's what happened at Surfside.
Hello? Okay, we're going to get this town hall meeting underway.
State officials came to Surfside to address that issue and others in the fall of 2006. Jerry Patterson is Texas Land Commissioner.
You know, there are those who say that this erosion is caused by man-made activity. I don't disagree. There are those that say, well, it's because of global warming. There are those that say all these other reasons. I'm not going to argue against that or in favor of that, but the question is, what do we do today?
Patterson offered a solution. He said the state would try to slow the erosion by putting $1 million worth of sand on the beach. That should help keep more houses from ending up by the water in the future. But as for the homes already on the beach, he said it's too late to save them. In fact, they have to go to make way for the sand.
What I'm telling you is the front row is in the way of anything we can do to preserve the other rows.
Patterson offered a solution there, too. He said the state would pay the cost of moving homes from the beach onto inland lots. More than a dozen homeowners accepted the offer. But 14 houses remain on the beach, and among these holdouts are Brooks and Mary Porter. They say the state's offer was inadequate. The state refused to pay them for their land.
Both the Texas and the United States Constitution spell it out that you cannot take property from individuals or from families without adequate compensation.
The state says it's not taking anyone's property. The Gulf of Mexico is. But this constitutional argument is the basis of the Porters' continuing lawsuit. That lawsuit is headed toward a state appeals court and possibly beyond.
We and some of the other people will fight this, if need be, all the way to the Supreme Court.
And a lot of people will be watching. How this case gets resolved could set a precedent far beyond Texas. What if rising seas threaten one day to swamp skyscrapers in Manhattan or entire towns in Florida? Whose responsibility will it be to move buildings out of the way? Who will take the hit for the lost property value? In Surfside, children still play around the homes on the beach. They scoop sand into buckets. They upend the buckets to build towers. They adorn the towers with shells and feathers.
A sand castle.
Then the tide turns and the castles of sand melt into the sea. For NPR News, I'm David Barron.
No, don't. And you can see just how close to the edge these homes are in an audio slideshow at our website, npr.org.
Support for the series Shifting Ground comes from the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. In the Mexican border town of Tijuana, just south of San Diego, a new machine could help clean up some of the city's social and environmental problems. A Tijuana teenager dreamed up the contraption 10 years ago. She has since dedicated her life to making her idea a reality. From member station KPBS in San Diego, Amy Isaacson reports.
As a teenager growing up in Tijuana, Miroslava Enciso Limon always wanted to be a firefighter. But her dream changed when her high school teacher assigned her to visit Tijuana's dump.
My name was picked for the dump. I was like, oh, they picked me for that?
Enciso knew that families lived at the dump in houses they made out of trash. They wore clothes from the trash. They lived by reselling any scraps they could find. She says it was gross.
But once you get there, it hits you. To see how people live, to see a kid eating garbage, to say to a kid, what's your dream? And they say a shower, to feel what it's like to have hot water fall on you.
Enciso says after the field trip, she didn't sleep for 2 days. A year later, she announced to her dad that she was going to build a machine to sort trash so people wouldn't have to.
It was a radical life change.
Enciso enrolled at Tijuana's Institute of Technology and got a degree in industrial engineering. During her last year, she designed the recycling machine. She knew it would never make it off the drawing board without backing from the city. Last year, with her plans in hand, Enciso began dogging candidates in the city's mayoral election. One of those candidates, and the eventual victor, was Jorge Ramos. He remembers meeting Enciso.
She was on a taxi, blowing the horn to her bus. So we stopped and she got in.
He told her she could have 5 minutes of his time.
I was very impressed about the way that she offered me that solution for the garbage. I gave her the phone of my house so that when I went, she could look for me, and she did. And now it's a reality.
City dump trucks back up to Enciso's recycling machine. It's up and running at a facility on Tijuana's east side. The machine is not especially high-tech. Blades rip open the garbage bags and spill the contents onto a conveyor belt. At times, the stench makes your eyes water. About 30 workers dressed in navy coveralls, face masks, and latex gloves sort the trash. All of them used to be scavengers at the dump. New employee Luisa Marquez says it was much harder when she was a scavenger.
Before, I left at 4 a.m., before the sun came up, because it'd get too hot. We'd have to open the bags, we'd get dirty, we'd get covered in food. We didn't have uniforms, we didn't have protection or a roof.
The machine's inventor, Enciso, says she could have automated the process more, but the idea is to employ as many scavengers from the dump as possible, about 200 when the machine is fully operational. They earn about $105 a week plus benefits. Marquez says there are other perks, too.
I find a lot of things, like clothes. We wash it with Clorox and wear it. The shoes, too. These shoes I'm wearing, I found here.
City officials eventually hope to recycle 60% of Tijuana's trash. Meanwhile, Enciso says the most difficult thing about the project has been that she's barely seen her two children in the last 4 months. But she tells them her work is not only helping people, but the environment.
I took my son to the dump so he could see how people lived, to show him this project is for them and for you, so your life is better tomorrow, and so you have air and water to live.
For NPR News, I'm Amy Isaacson in Tijuana.
We have a story now about chocolate and a disease that brought it down in southeastern Brazil. And it's a story about unintended consequences of how a small thing, a fungus, affected two large things, a way of life and a watershed. Taken together, they prove the first law of ecology. In nature, everything is connected. NPR's Joanne Silberna reports.
Bahia in eastern Brazil is one of those lush tropical paradises. Everywhere you look, up, down, sideways, something is growing. This was once the center of the chocolate universe. On a hillside in Bahia, Claudio De Simone reflects on his role as a major player in the chocolate industry.
I had a very nice, a beautiful farm, in fact. I was a rich man.
The farm meant the world to him. It was thick with short, squat cacao trees studded with pods, brightly colored and football-shaped, the source of chocolate. It was a 500-acre heirloom.
For my family, my grandfather, it starts in 1919.
70 years later, on his watch, disaster struck. A fungal infection swept Bahia. Witch's broom, a fungus that attacks only cacao trees. That's the very little thing. A fungus carried on puffs of wind. It made De Simone's cacao trees look awful.
They look completely different because the plants start dying, almost dying, because all the leaves drop and they are completely brown.
Clusters of dead leaves and stunted little branches looked like, well, witches' brooms stuck on the cacao trees. Desimone went out with his workers, chopping off infected branches, planting new trees he thought might be resistant. It was like the sorcerer's apprentice. He couldn't keep up. With mist in his eyes, he says, the stress killed his wife. Finally, in 2001, the government declared Desimone's farm non-productive. That meant they could seize it and give it to landless people.
And now I'm poor, but I was rich.
He doesn't know what happened to his farm.
No, I never more went there. I believe that I can't see the farm anymore.
This very small fungus brought down not only Desimone. Cacao production across the entire region plunged nearly 75%. Brazil went from being the third leading cocoa producer to 13th, and all because of witch's broom. This same fungus changed something else as well. By destroying the cacao trees, it changed an entire ecosystem. In the watershed that contained Desimone's farm, the ground is hard and dry in many places. Before the fungus, there used to be more than 1 million acres of lush rainforest here. The soil was moist and absorbent. But with the infestation of the cacao trees, people cut down the forest to make money from timber and pasture land instead. The exposed soil was tamped down by hooves and burned dry by the sun. And with that came huge changes to the water flow. Naylor Calasanz works at the Universidade Estadual de Santa Cruz in the city of Itabuna on the Cachoeira River. He takes us to his lab to show us what's been happening since the fungus hit.
You're almost there. Almost.
Calasanz has been charting water flow and precipitation in the watershed. He's got the data all mapped out on huge rolls of laminated paper. He pulls one from a stand.
This is one project that we had. We have some equipments inside the watershed monitoring the discharge, the daily discharge, and also the precipitations and temperature and things like that.
Squiggly red and green and blue lines on the graph show what happened when the land changed.
As long as we change it for pasture, the water is not able to enter the soil and just touch the soil and run off.
So when it rains, instead of being absorbed by the spongy soil, the water rushes straight off the hard-packed dirt and into the river. Calasanz's charts show that now there's sometimes no water left in the ground to feed the river during the dry season. There have been days where in the city of Itabuna, the river simply doesn't flow.
And this is causing several problems because Itabuna, they are having problems of water supply for the city.
And all because of a microscopic fungus that attacked a crop, that made a farmer lose his farm, that turned lush dark forests into dried out pasture land, and changed the way a river flowed. But people are fighting back.
Do you know this bird? It's called Japu. You see? They are black and yellow. And they are, look, they are coming there.
Former cacao farmer Claudio Desimone is now a manager at a government-subsidized tree nursery. At a stage in his life where he expected to be retired and watching his daughter run the family farm, he's supplying all sorts of trees to local farmers, fruit trees, and trees whose wood can be harvested sustainably. And the nursery even has some cacao trees that may be resistant to the dreaded witch's broom fungus.
I didn't solve my problem, but I probably will solve the problems of another farms.
The government's aim is to bring the land back closer to the original rainforest. As farmers plant the trees, chocolate may or may not thrive again in Bahia, but the other trees will make the soil moist and spongy, and maybe water will once again flow in the river on hot, dry days. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
And you can find a photo essay on how chocolate goes from bean to bar on our website, npr.org.